Rise, oi, 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 all fresh and ever fitting on the army. And everything, cool people, fetching lane, drawn out and giving attention. But his honorable court is now in session. God save the United States and his honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. This is the matter of Randolph Gurley versus Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Are counsel ready to proceed? All right. Counsel, what I'll do, since we have a motion to dismiss, we'll let the proponent of the motion go first, 10 minutes each side, and then we'll move into the principal case in chief. Ms. White.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Yvette Robinson White, and along with me today is Deputy Assistant General Counsel Edward B. Cassidy, Jr. The Secretary requests that the court dismiss the appellant's EJIA application. The reason being for the dismissal, the submission of the motion to dismiss, is upon a determination, upon getting ready for oral argument, looked at the basis for the remand and made a determination at that point in time that there was a jurisdictional issue sitting before the court, possibly. Secretary looked at Heath v. West. In Heath v. West, this court stated that if the court lacks jurisdiction over the EJIA application, the court does not have jurisdiction over the underlying claim. The court on numerous occasions pursuant to Harris has found that in cases dealing with where it did not have jurisdiction, it dismissed those claims. The parties in this case determined that the claim, the increased rating claim, was inextricably intertwined with issues that were pending and adjudicating before the agency, and determined that to avoid piecemeal litigation and to conserve judicial economy, that the case should be remanded. Because the essence of Harris is that the determination was of the board decision was non-final, Secretary thought it appropriate, pursuant to Heath v. West, to request that the court dismiss the EJIA application for not having jurisdiction of the underlying claim.
What's the impact of Scarborough and Arbaugh on the on our jurisdiction, on our view of jurisdiction?
Well, in terms of jurisdiction, if the court can review these cases, the court in Burkhart v. Gober determined that the court has to determine its jurisdiction. Matter of fact, it said it must determine its jurisdiction prior to adjudicating its case, the EJIA application. So I don't think that it precludes the court.
It comes down to whether or not it's a final board decision, does it not?
That's correct.
If it's a final board decision, we have jurisdiction. If it's not, we don't.
Correct.
And in Harris, the court discussed jurisdictional concepts. At that time, we know the 120-day was definitely viewed as a jurisdictional issue. And they determined that because it was intertwined, it was not a final decision. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. But in Smith, the Federal Circuit didn't view these as jurisdictional or final decisions, did they? Smith v. Gober, Federal Circuit, cited in the basis for remand, joint motion for order vacating, 236 Fed 3rd.
You mean in the Secretary's motion for remand?
In the joint motion for order vacating, in part, the board decision and incorporating the terms of the remand. You cited to Smith.
Correct.
Let me just finish. And there they viewed it as a judicial economy issue and not a jurisdictional issue.
Well, the bottom line it comes down to is what happened in this particular case, that it was non-final. The reason being that it was non-final is because the actual board decision dealt with an increased rating claim, and the parties looking at the entire record determined that it was in the interest of judicial economy in order to send it back.
Well, let's assume the appellant had not appealed that decision. On its face, it appeared to be final, did it not?
On its face, yes.
Okay, the finality. They didn't appeal it, and the time period had passed, and 3 years later they came in and tried to appeal that decision. What would the Secretary's position have been?
Well, depending upon how the issue was presented 3 years later, and if the case before the RO and the board, it could have been final. Currently, that case has pretty much been determined back at the RO, and it's pretty much final at this point.
So if the board issues a decision that appears to be final but may not be final because somewhere down the road it's interpreted to be interlocking with the other decisions that were remanded, the veteran is kind of between a rock and a hard place, is he not?
Well, it's not as though in this particular case where the veteran did receive, I'll use the facts of this case, where he did receive a grant to 20%, that he's hanging in limbo. He's just waiting until the additional development had been completed. There had been a remand in June of 2000 previously, where it was determined that these issues were inextricably intertwined and that the RO should adjudicate all the issues. It went to the board, and the board sent it back once again in 2003, stating that they needed to wait until the issues had all been adjudicated. Because the issues, because that particular issue still had not been completed, and although the board had completed, they acknowledged that it had not been fit, that all of the directions that were requested in that first remand still had to be accomplished. So answer to
I guess
the question
what I'm getting at
is if they would, I don't mean to cut you off, Judge Castle, but the answer to your question simply is he stuck between a rock and a hard place? No. I think that if he would have appealed that claim to the court, we would look to see what the jurisdictional issue was on that particular claim. He wouldn't be precluded from appealing that case.
Well, it certainly raises an issue, it seems to me. But the bottom line is, we do have Harris, which indicates that it's jurisdictional, and I guess the question I was trying to get at is that a valid decision? Is it truly jurisdictional, or was it a final decision? And for judicial economy purposes, it should be held or remanded back to the board for action to be taken. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, if the case, I would think that pursuant to, as the court went through the analysis in Harris, where it determines that the board, in order for the court to have jurisdiction, that the decision has to be final. If the decision is non-final, then it is a jurisdiction question. I don't see how you get around where, if it's remanded for judicial economy, and the court doesn't want to review it because it's piecemeal, it would seem to be jurisdiction. It's non-final. The court only receives its jurisdiction of a board decision based on the finality of the board decision. If it's not final, it would be jurisdiction. I don't see how you get around that.
What if the decision was final? Could the court anyway send the case back to avoid piecemeal litigation?
Well, pursuant to Harris, it was in two circumstances. It said piecemeal litigation, and I guess it comes down to judicial economy. That would be the standard if it was judicial economy and piecemeal litigation.
So you could we could have jurisdiction over a particular issue. It's just that we feel that for judicial economy purposes, it ought to be. Something else has to be done below before we should entertain it.
It comes back to whether or not the court determines that it's final or non-final. If those issues, if it doesn't render that the board decision.
Well, it's
is
not a
final.
Question of judicial economy, is it, if it's non-final? I mean, if the decision is non-final, we just simply don't have jurisdiction.
That's correct.
Can't
get around that.
So when Harris talks about judicial economy or to avoid piecemeal litigation,
Well, if I may, Chief, the Harris does specifically say it's jurisdictional, and I gather the Secretary's point is that Harris is still on the books, not directly overruled, and I was trying to get at whether or not Smith, Federal Circuit case, subsequent there too, which talked in terms of judicial economy, and the more recent cases of Scarborough and Arbrough from the Supreme Court, which further enlightened us as to what jurisdiction was, and that perhaps the 120 days requirement was not jurisdictional. If you go back to Harris and take a look at it, it's clear that the 120-day requirement was bothersome to the court, because if they did not take this and send it back, the 120-day period left, then you might have a final decision sitting out there. And it appears to me as though they approached it from that standpoint and concluded the way around that, or the way to address that issue, was to consider it non-final. And so my question is, and I see a very perplexed face there, but my question is Harris, can it be distinguished? Should it be overruled by en banc? Should it be followed?
The Secretary believes that Harris should still be followed. Of course, now, in terms of the 120-day rule, I have to honestly say that we do not have a particular position on, in terms of what that would mean in terms of Harris. That would be some thought that I would, the Secretary would need to give, instead of me sitting here trying to work a way through it. I think that the biggest issue is when looking at this issue of jurisdiction and whether or not it should we should have submitted a motion to dismiss, is that the law on the books at this point in time was Harris. It had not been overruled. We have looked at cases thereafter that has utilized Harris v. Dewinsky, has dismissed
I agree.
His claim.
Your motion that you came in for jurisdictional raises the issue that Harris raises, but in your original motion, this is why I said the appellant is in a rock between a rock and a hard place, both of you focused on the interest of judicial economy, the avoidance of piecemeal litigation, and cited to Smith v. Gober. You did have a cite to Harris, but not for its jurisdictional purposes in the first round.
Well, in the first in the first sentence of the joint motion for remand, we said that we were remanding pursuant to Harris, and the precepts that come from Harris deal specifically with a non-final decision, although it was not stated specifically within the actual joint motion for remand. It wasn't the major focus.
So you both just didn't catch that Harris. The remedy in Harris is dismissal rather than remand.
Correct.
Okay. We're past your time, and you'll have the. Just save your question, Judge.
I will.
Is it the court, please? Kenneth Carper. Excuse me, Carpenter, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Curley.
Sometimes we think you do, Carp.
He does, I'm afraid. Also appearing as Glenda Pearl. To address the jurisdictional question, I believe that Harris is both distinguishable in the sense that although it does refer to jurisdiction, the disposition in Harris was a question of remedy, and that the holding in Harris is the necessity of the board to deal with inextricably intertwined claims at the same time. The question in the early days of the court, as Judge Kessel had correctly observed, was the impact of whether or not that adversely affected the appellant's right to appeal, because he had to appeal within 120 days of that first decision on one of the two issues, which is precisely what happened here. Clearly, we believe that Smith implicitly overrules Harris on the jurisdictional aspect of Harris, not on the substantive aspect, but also, and more importantly, the federal court discussed this court's analysis of its jurisdiction in the Hudson case and in the Halpern 1 case, and specifically pointed out that when Mr. Hudson challenged the dismissal for lack of jurisdiction in Hudson, following essentially the same analysis as was applied in Harris, the Federal Circuit found that that jurisdictional determination was incorrect, because the correct focus needs to be on whether or not there was a 7252A decision. And there was a decision by the board.
But didn't the court in Hudson really turn their decision on the fact that this court had acted as though they were remanding the case, even though they spoke in terms of jurisdiction?
Well, and that was essentially what happened in Harris, Your Honor, and what has happened in this case. And that's why I say it is a matter of the remedy.
But
and
in Hudson, our court had directed further action by the board, even though it dismissed the case.
That's correct. And that was one of the enhancing facts in that particular case. But essentially, at least by implication, that's precisely what the court did in Harris in its analysis of the inextricably intertwined claims.
What do you do with that line of cases that the Hudson court cites, all standing for the proposition that if there is no jurisdiction, there can be no EJIA fees?
Well, that was the holding in Burkhart. But ironically, in Burkhart, that was the same circumstance that presented itself in Hudson. The court had made a determination that there was no jurisdiction because there was a pending claim, and therefore the appropriate remedy was dismissal. Mr. Burkhart's counsel did not do as Mr. Hudson's counsel had done and attack the CAVC's jurisdictional determination or the remedy based upon that jurisdictional determination. And when they did address it in Hudson, they distinguished it by saying you had to focus on, and the correct focus is on, was there an adverse decision by the board which implicated this court's jurisdiction? Quite clearly there was in Harris, quite clearly there was in Hudson, and most particularly in this case, there was. There was an adverse decision, as Judge Caswell correctly pointed out to counsel for the government, that adversely decided one of the two inextricably intertwined issues. And that decision was final unless some affirmative action was taken. And the only affirmative action to be taken was a notice of appeal. Quite candidly, I think that the government should have not entered into a joint remand, but simply articulated this position in a responsive brief about what the appropriate disposition was in light of Harris, whether it was a remand or whether it was dismissal in accordance with Harris. And then we would have been able to join that issue and possibly gone to the en banc court to decide that question as to whether or not Harris was correctly decided in terms of its remedy, not in terms of its analysis of inextricably intertwined.
But in your view, only appeal would resolve the conundrum that a veteran would find himself in, where he's faced with an apparently final decision by the board as to one of his claims, and there are others that he feels are inextricably intertwined. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what we have in this fact set, and the reason that Mr. Gurley appealed, is that his motion, his request for increase on his knee disability started at a point earlier in time than the actual application that was made for TDIU. Therefore, there is a difference in timing in relationship to the effective date, which is why it is critical under Harris to have the inextricably intertwined nature, because you end up dealing with potentially two claims for increase, the effective date of which, in our view, would be controlled by the first, and that's why, as inextricably intertwined claims, they should be dealt with in the same adjudicatory proceeding. It does raise the question as to whether or not these are even separate claims, a claim for increase or an application for TDIU, but next month this court's going to deal with that issue in another case.
Was there any clarification by you when you were representing Mr. Gurley before the board as to whether or not the board had intended for the RO to, in fact, consider the knee disability?
No, except to the extent that there were no discussions. I had no opportunity to have any dialogue with the board, and so that's the direct answer to your question. But what the board did unusually in this case was to, in fact, increase the rating on the knee from 10% to 20%, and it seems to us that once they did that, that clearly based upon that determination of an increase in severity in the knee disability, that that obviously was part and parcel of the assessment as to how it did or didn't affect unemployability, which was the issue that was remanded, and that the appropriate remedy by the board, in our view, should have been a remand after the increase to 10% and saying that further consideration of the rating on the knee would be deferred until the regional office decided the question of TDIU.
Have you considered whether or not Harris can be distinguished given the subsequent Supreme Court decisions in Scarborough and Arbar with regard to the 120-day and whether that was part of the basis for their determination, or is it so clear that Harris determined it was not a final decision if it was inextricably intertwined that we have to go en banc? Have you thought about that?
I have not, Your Honor. And I don't see, as I have listened to your comments about that this morning, how that 120-day analysis in Scarborough could really affect Harris to the extent that this court may need to go en banc to address that, unless this court is prepared to recognize that the holding in Smith and the holding in Hudson and Halperin implicitly overrule Harris. Clearly, I think the panel could do that as opposed to having to go en banc, but it certainly would not be inappropriate to go en banc to address what is clearly a unquestionable decision that the appropriate remedy is dismissal. And I would suggest that the appropriate remedy simply cannot be dismissal. It's got to be an exercise of jurisdiction by this court and a remand to vacate that decision, which, in our view, is precisely what was done here. So unless there's any further questions.
Vacate this decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why are you returning it, for judicial economy or for what reason?
Well, because, in the first place, the board didn't comply with its 7104A obligation to apply all laws, which would have been Harris. And therefore, the decision was not made in accordance with law and therefore should be held unlawful and set aside. I did note that the clerk's order that granted the joint remand referred to the matter being remanded. Now, remanded is a term that is used in 7252. It is not a term that is used in 7261. 7261 is that portion of the statute which deals with vacate and set aside. And so to that extent, we do have somewhat of a gap in this court's jurisprudence, and notwithstanding the recent footnote that says set aside and vacate are the same thing, is remand the same thing? And that may be what we get to in the merit discussion of this appeal.
Let me ask one more question. Why would there be a 7104 requirement on the board to address an issue of this court's jurisdiction?
Oh, no, not this court's jurisdiction. The inextricably intertwined. They were bound by the substantive holding in Harris that you do not dispose of inextricably intertwined matters differently. And that's what they did here. They granted an increase, but no higher than 20%, which was an adverse decision and a final decision, and they remanded the TDIU claim.
So are you saying that the board in this instance
yes.
should not have finally decided any portion of this claim that was determined to be inextricably intertwined?
No, I believe that they could decide, as they did, to increase from 10 to 20, but they committed error when they made that the end of their decision. Once they made that decision, they should have deferred further consideration of whether Mr. Gurley was or wasn't entitled to increased compensation based upon their decision to remand the TDIU claim. As Ms. White pointed out, they had repeatedly, in two prior remands, observed the inextricably intertwined nature of these claims. And then apparently they simply lost sight of it in this last decision.
So if they had acted as you've just suggested, then that would have taken the veteran off the hook with regard to...
Absolutely. There would have been no final decision. And that's precisely the 7252 dilemma. Once there's a final decision, then we have to initiate an appeal.
Since you're standing there, we'll move into your time
okay.
as on the principal.
And I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, if the court please.
You want to reserve 10 of the 20?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's how we're going to do it. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know.
If you want to. I mean, I was just going
well,
to.
No. I thought we were going to start the clock all over again. If we're going to deduct 10 off the top from both sides, that's fine. I just didn't understand that from the court's initial remarks. So I've got 20 total. All right. Yes, 10 I would like to defer or reserve, excuse me.
And we're flexible.
If the court please, on the question of whether or not Mr. Gurley is a prevailing party, we believe that Mr. Gurley is a prevailing party because under the plain language of the EJA statute at 2412D1 capital A, Mr. Gurley did initiate a civil action, and that civil action was an appeal of the final decision by the board granting an increase of from 10 to 20%, but no higher for his left knee disability. And when he obtained
a final decision. And then it became inextricably intertwined and not a final decision.
Oh, no. It was an inextricably intertwined matter before they made their decision, and that's where the board's error comes from under Harris. You see, we can't simply
focus. So the 20% decision.
There's nothing that prohibits the board from bumping it from 10 to 20 and then deferring a final disposition on what that rating should be pending the outcome. If they had simply deferred that.
But you could always seek 30%.
Absolutely. And they could have been remanded as part of the inextricably intertwined question that the board found in reviewing that it should be bumped from 10 to 20, but they weren't going to consider 30 on the basis of this record and send it back to the board, to the RO with the TDIU claim. Because obviously both address the question of whether or not there had been an increase in the level of disability in other terms, in terms of the compensation that he should be entitled to. And obviously, even if he got a scheduler increase to 30, the award of TDIU, which he did subsequently get on remand, obviously subsumes, if you will, that scheduler concept, because then he goes to a total rating. The question then becomes effective date, which is why it's critical that these two issues are inextricably intertwined, because they have different application dates, different filing dates.
Mr. Carpenter, do
yes,
you agree
sir.
With me that in this court, for EJA payments to be awarded, the remand must be predicated on error?
No, I do not. I believe that this court has made an en banc decision in Sumner and Vaughan, which was implicitly overruled by the holdings of the Federal Circuit in Motorola, in Rice, and in Halperin. And in all three of those cases, as was recognized by this court in Zuberi, although it did refer to that test, the test that is articulated by the Federal Circuit does not include that requirement.
Okay.
And therefore, the controlling case law is not this court's en banc decision in Sumner, which does require a concession of error.
As cited in Zuberi, as cited in Scarborough. But anyway, I understand your position.
Yes.
But follow me on this. Except for the purposes of the next minute or two, that it is predicated on error.
Mm-hmm.
Where in this JMR, and this is a joint motion review, not a court decision, which
right.
requires a concession of error. Where in this JMR is a concession of error?
I think in the very first line, where it says that the board did not comply. Now, I suggest that it is not necessary, nor is it appropriate, for this court to be reviewing to determine whether magic words were issued, or excuse me, were included, but whether there is a clear agreement by the parties that a mistake was made. And that very first sentence says the board did not comply with Harris. And when the board did not comply with Harris, as I previously discussed, they committed a 7104A error, and therefore that decision must be held unlawful and set aside. Now, the language, as I mentioned earlier, that was used in the clerk's order was remand. It was not held unlawful or set aside. So to the extent that the court's order didn't deal with that, mayhaps this court needs to go the next step and determine that when the court remands, the court does, in fact, set aside the board's decision. Because clearly that's what's required here, is for the board to set aside its decision. Yes, for the board to have its decision set aside so that that claim on the increased rating for the left knee can continue to be pending. And that matter is now on remand to the board and presumably will go back to the agency of original jurisdiction based upon the remand that was made for the claim.
Taking your joint motion where it says parties agree that remand is warranted to comply with the court's holding in Harris, the court's holding in Harris was that the decision was not final.
I do not believe, I believe that that was the remedy that was fashioned based upon that legal determination.
All right, accepting but what you wrote in the joint JMR, the court's decision in Harris, as further discussed in Smith, which you cite, is that in the interest of judicial economy, an avoidance of piecemeal litigation requires that the claims be adjudicated together.
And the reason for that is, Your Honor, the reference that was made earlier to the fact that we have a TDIU claim that was remanded and has now been awarded, and now we're going to be quibbling about the effective date for the award of TDIU. So that piecemeal litigation is avoided if the agency has both inextricably intertwined pieces of the claim for increase back before it, as opposed to before this court. Because then this court would have to decide a question that simply is premature until the decision which has now been...
Is the error the board's decision, or is the error your appeal?
The error is the board's decision. Now, we had no choice, Your Honor. We were put between the rock and the hard place. We were delivered a final decision that the knee disability would increase from 10 to 20, but not to 30. And therefore, the maximum benefit available under law was not granted.
But the Secretary indicated that after those remanded claims came back up, this particular decision would have been considered, and that you could have made the arguments, et cetera. So if you had not appealed this, according to what the Secretary told us, and waited until the remanded claims came back up, could have pointed out that they were inextricably intertwined, and the matter could have been decided at that particular time. In fact, as you read Smith versus Gober, all it really says is, we should remand it back to the board. Not that the board should do anything, but perhaps sit on it until the other two claims came back up.
I agree that there is no
explicit... So is there a concession of error? I guess what I'm trying to get at is you would like to read the words warranted to comply, but those certainly are not the words we committed error.
Well, Your Honor, let's try to put this in context. Appellant had filed his opening brief. The government came back to the appellant and offered a remand. We would not have conceded to the remand under the terms that you suggested if that was what we understood the terms of the remand to be, because we wanted that decision vacated, and we believe that that's what we got in that joint remand. If that's not what we got, then, quite frankly, I don't have any problem with withdrawing the joint remand, and let's go ahead and proceed and litigate Harris. Now, the question then becomes, how do you interpret Harris in light of Smith, in light of Scarborough, in light...
So was the decision vacated?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I believe
that... So the 20% reward was revoked?
No, because it was expressly reserved in the terms of the joint remand, which I think gives even further credence to the position that the appellant believed...
What was set aside, or what was vacated?
The decision to deny an award of 20%, more than 20% for the left knee, and that's all. The other issues, I believe there was a back claim and a hemorrhoid claim or
appeal,
something.
Your appeal was always directed to the Harris issue?
Yes. Yes. In our opening brief, that's what we relied upon.
Forgive me. Point to me in the JMR where you retained the 20%.
It's on the second page.
Page two.
The bottom.
The last sentence of the first paragraph, notably the board in its decision granted an increased rating from 10 to 20, present disability for a service-connected post-operative residuals left knee, which increase should not be disturbed.
Okay.
But that wasn't done anyway, was it? There's no vacation by the court?
Well, frankly, it depends on how you read your clerk's order, Your Honor. If I may be so bold, I don't think the clerk should be issuing such orders, that this court should be issuing those orders for this very reason. But the fact is that order does not make clear what happened other than it was remanded to the board. I am suggesting that the term remanded, particularly when 7252 uses the phrase remanded as appropriate, needs to be fleshed out. Because, as Judge Castle quite correctly points out, one could interpret that to mean for jurisdictional purposes, or it could mean to vacate and set aside. And that ambiguity is a function of both, I believe, the parties and the clerk's office in drafting that order.
Let's talk about that order just for a minute. Mm-hmm. It also incorporated, which was a request by the JMR.
Correct.
And I understand the basis for incorporation came about because of a case Breeden and some doubts that were created out in the bar with regard to whether the terms could be enforced.
Correct.
Was that not recently resolved in the Forcier decision, 19 Fed App 414, where the court said that the terms can be enforced? And if you don't have it off the top of your head, accept it just for now.
No, I do, Your Honor. I don't know that that necessarily does resolve it in light of this court's apparent willingness to go back and re-examine the terms of the joint remand, which was even done in that case. I believe that the better rule needs to be to follow what I believe is the fairly clear dictate from the Federal Circuit in Rice, Halperin, and in which the requirement was simply for a remand, acknowledging in Motorola, that was the other case, that there are certain exceptions to that rule when there is a change in law. And clearly this is not a change in law remand.
No, how does that apply to the incorporate? I guess let me go on one further. It seems to me that this JMR, which called for a remand, didn't discuss the issue of dismissal in Harris.
No.
It's inherently got its own problems. I might point out that Smith versus Gober's site appears to be wrong also. And yet the parties asked the court to actually incorporate this within the order, and the clerk in this court has been doing that. I must question the practice of incorporating joint motions for remand by the parties as part of the court's order. And if the only reason is to get an enforcement of the JMR itself, Forcier specifically says that the JMR can be enforced, assuming it's not contrary to law, which of course would be the case in the JMR. So the practice of incorporating carries with it problems, it seems to me, and no real benefit given that Forcier has been issued and clarified, I believe, Breeden, or concerns that might have been raised by Breeden.
All right, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. White.
Appellant is not a prevailing party. The issue that is before this court today is whether or not the appellant is a prevailing party. This court recently in Vahey v. Nicholson and Zaberi v. Nicholson stated that the standard or the test to be utilized to determine if appellant is a prevailing party as if there has been, if the remand was predicated upon administrative error. In order to come up with that determination, the court stated that it would have to either be a concession of error by the secretary or a court recognition of error by the court.
What about these words, remand is warranted to comply with the court's holding in Harris versus Dewinsky? I mean, doesn't that infer that there's some lack of compliance that requires remand?
No, and looking at the court's determination in Akers, where Judge Hagel was talking in his concurrence about how specific you have to be in the actual joint motion for remand and looking to the four corners of that document. He was, the court was remanding Akers pursuant to Gordon, and in that JMR, it said pursuant to Gordon. There was no concession of error, no statement of 7104, as Judge Hagel said. In this case, just a reference to Harris, a case where there was no error found, that would be insufficient in order to make a determination that there was error in that particular case.
So would you require the JMR to say this is a confession of error by the Secretary?
Absolutely, and on most occasions when the Secretary is conceding error, it's stated that there has been error pursuant to 7104A.
What kind of a position would that leave the appellant's counsel in, where the Secretary has indicated a willingness to remand a case and appellant's counsel thinks that's in his client's interest but would really like to get those words in there, this is a confession of error? Isn't appellant's counsel put in a difficult position of trying to balance, which he shouldn't, his client's interests against his own interests?
And that's exactly what was before us in terms of whether or not we should put in the statements of error. If it has to be placed inside, error has to be placed inside the joint motion for remand, it's pretty much put there because the counsel will probably be submitting an EJIA application.
So why would the Secretary not insist on having language in the joint motion that said this is not a confession of error?
Well, at times there is error.
No, but what if there is no error and you're asserting here that the appellant is not a prevailing party?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't the Secretary in this joint motion say this is not a concession of error?
Because there was no error. We remanded because it was in the interest of judicial economy and piecemeal litigation. And looking at the state of the record, we thought it was in the best interest of the appellant. We still have a concomitant duty in order to look out for the interests of the appellant in these cases. And in this particular case, that's exactly what came into the thinking in terms of an agreement, in terms of the JMR with the appellant. As stated previously, the appellant in this case is not a prevailing party. There was no concession of error in the joint motion for remand, and there was no court recognition of error in the court's remand. All that was stated in the order is that the case was remanded. Pursuant to Bredell, the determination has to be within the four corners of the actual document, and it must be explicit. There has been no explicit statement in this case that there was any type of error.
Are you aware of any panel case where EJIA with ease have been awarded where the JMR has used the terms is warranted to comply with the court's holding in any case and did not use the terms concession of error? Let me restate that.
I just want to make certain that I understand
right.
You, yes.
Let me just
is
restate.
There any?
Are you aware of any panel or en banc case from the court, precedential case from the court, where EJIA fees have been awarded based on a JMR that used the terms warranted to comply with the court's holding in a case and did not use the terms concession of error, admission of error, confession of error?
Directly the exact language, no, but the closest would have to be in Akers with the JMR being remanded for Gordon, pursuant to Gordon, not the word.
And they did not award EJIA in that case?
No, they did not. Okay.
Was this clearly then a remand for procedural compliance?
It was pretty much in terms of procedural. When initially looking at this case, I have to say that I have remanded on several occasions for Harris, along with other issues. And upon first blush looking at the case, You would think that it was, you know, for procedural reasons, and you look to Harris to see that all the issues are inextricably intertwined, and not necessarily recognizing that it was a jurisdictional issue at the time that we made. So in answer to your question, although this puts this into a different different light in terms of the thinking that went through in this case, because it should have been a dismissal, a request for dismissal versus a request for remand. When cases are inextricably intertwined, they dismiss pursuant to Harris. But at the time when the joint motion for remand was done, we did it in the interest of judicial economy and thinking that it was okay to remand. So in essence, it was probably, in actuality, it was treated as though it was procedural versus a judicial type of action, jurisdictional action. Additionally, this case, as although stated previously in terms of Vehe and Zuberi, is more like the cases of Sumner, Vaughn, Akers, and Burdell, which gave the appellant an opportunity for further adjudication of the claim. However, the determinations of Motorola and Halpern, in those cases, the appellant, although I think the point that the counsel was trying to make as with the court, is that because he has received a remand for what he was requesting, he should still be a prevailing party. In these cases, the bottom line comes down to, was there an error? You cannot get around in any of these decisions, such as in Motorola, whether there was some type of error.
On that
whether
issue,
there was a
what about this court's decision in Cycle, CYCHOLL? I'm not sure that I pronounce it correctly. But in that case, prior to the board's decision, the VCAA was passed. And then the board made its decision not referencing the VCAA, and this court said, as I read that decision, that there was error, notwithstanding the fact that the secretary had not confessed error, had not indicated error, and that it was a violation of 7104 for the board not to have discussed the VCAA. How do you square that?
And that's exactly correct, because it was pursuant to 7104. It was a law that it was based upon. There was no specific law.
7104 merely requires that the board address all applicable laws. Wouldn't that embrace addressing Harris?
Well, not in a case, I bring the court back to Akers, not in a case where there was no, in that decision, there's no underlying error determination, no. In Cycle, the error was that the VCAA had been passed, which was a law that was supposed to be applied. In this particular case, there has been no law that needed to be applied.
Well, aren't the decisions of this court binding on the VA? And aren't they required to be applied by the board?
Well, you have to look at what was happening in Harris. And first, before you look at what was happening at Harris, in order to make a determination prevailing party, you have to look at what actually occurred in the four corners of that document. In that document, there was no concession of error. So even...
Let me just read briefly. I don't want to belabor the point, but let me read briefly from court's decision in Cycle. It said in part, the board unquestionably violated 38 U.S.C. 7104A and D1 in failing to address the potentially applicable law, i.e. the VCAA, that had been enacted and became effective while a veteran's claim was pending. That said, all in the context of nowhere in this motion did the secretary acknowledge error, and because alternatively, in remanding the matter, the court did not recognize administrative error, which was the government's position in that case.
But the court recognized.
The court recognized the 7104 violation.
And that's the point in terms of whether the...
But as I understand counsel's argument in this case for the appellant, this is a 7104 violation, that the board failed to apply all applicable laws, which is what 7104 requires.
However, in order to make a determination of EJIA, the court needs to make that determination. There was no, in the order, the court did not make that determination. The court can only look to what actually happened in that joint motion for remand and exactly what its statement was in its order. Its order at no time made a pronouncement of error, that it was a 7104 error. In conclusion, because appellant has not demonstrated that he that there was a concession of error by the secretary or that the court did not recognize error in its order, the court should dismiss appellant's EJIA application as not because he's not a prevailing party. Thank you for consideration.
Thank you, Ms. White. Mr. Carpenter.
Judge Mullen, I'd like to talk about the question that you raised, which is the client's interest versus the attorney's interest. I believe that that is an unfortunate misconception that exists. And this case, quite frankly, is the perfect example. Mr. Gurley is entitled to an offset of these EJIA fees. These are Mr. Gurley's EJIA fees. These are not my fees. And under the Carpenter decision, I am obligated to offset because we have prevailed on the related issue of TDIU, which was the whole purpose of the inextricably intertwined remand that we obtained by joint remand from the government. And therefore, Mr. Gurley was required under the plain language of EJIA to correct the mistake made by the board by going forward and making a final decision on the knee disability. In order to correct that error, he had to file a civil action. He filed an appeal in this court, and he prevailed in this court because that decision was, in the terms of the remand, in the terms of the clerk's order, remanded. I believe that this court needs to find that a remand in the context of this case, similar to Seichel, was a finding implicitly of a 7104A violation for the very terms set out in the first sentence of the basis of the joint remand for the failure to comply with Harris. Harris was not a change in law. For the government to stand up before you and say that Sumner, Vaughan, Bridell, and Akers apply is simply incorrect.
Is 7104A error, is this a 7104A error committed in a non-final board decision?
No, sir. If this is a final board decision, the
so
only
it's
way
only non-final once you get to a Harris review?
No, once you get to a order from this court vacating and setting aside that decision or ordering a remand.
But the joint motion for remand said that under Harris, it was premature to
that parties agree that a remand is warranted.
Because?
Because of the holding of this court in Harris, without any specificity
says,
to what that holding was.
Well, what is the holding in Harris?
The holding in Harris, I believe, is twofold. The holding in Harris is first that when there are inextricably intertwined claims, it is the obligation of the agency to adjudicate both claims simultaneously and not make a final decision on one without making a final decision on the other.
And that the
decision remedy
that's made is not final.
Well, that's right. And that's the holding in Harris. But I believe that that holding in Harris was overturned implicitly by Smith first, which was what was cited in the remand, but also by the Federal Circuit's decisions in Hudson and Halpern, because the jurisdictional determination, the remedial determination relative to this court's jurisdiction in Harris was wrong. This court did have jurisdiction in Harris. There was no non-final decision. There was only a final decision. The non-final decision was on the inextricably intertwined TDIU claim.
But if it's remanded for judicial economy purposes, then it did not have to be remanded, which would mean there was no necessary error below.
Well, obviously, it's a matter of beauties in the eye of the beholder. As I understood the judicial economy reference, it was continued to briefing this matter and asking this court to make a decision on this matter. I don't see it taking into account judicial economy in any other fashion other than to short-circuit this appeal by disposition, by joint agreement of the parties. I'm not sure what your Honor is suggesting would be the judicial economy that would benefit this court otherwise from a joint remand under Harris. Now I think
So we could have proceeded.
Yes.
We could have addressed these issues.
Yes.
Rendered a final decision on that claim.
And could have decided whether Harris was correctly decided on the jurisdictional question, or I suppose you could have gone back and decided the substantive question in Bonk. But I think that the substantive question under Smith has been adopted.
Except Harris is overturned. Just accept that.
Mm-hmm. Then what this court would have done would have been to found, as we alleged in our brief, that there was a 7104A violation when the board failed to consider and apply Harris.
What,
Harris,
our judicial economy purposes?
I'm at a loss. For the obligation of the board to adjudicate inextricably intertwined claims together, not separately.
But if it doesn't impact their decision as being final, then it's not per se an obligation.
And that was the jurisdictional remedy that was decided in Harris. And that jurisdictional remedy has been disavowed by the Federal Circuit first in Harris.
Correct. And so if it's not jurisdictional, it's not required, it doesn't impact our jurisdiction, we can review the matter. If we can review the matter, you're still saying it necessarily has to be remanded.
Absolutely, because there is a 7104A violation. They violated the substantive rule in Harris. They decided to remand the TDIU claim, and they made a final decision on the knee disability. They had previously said in two different board remands that these issues were inextricably intertwined. They can't become non-inextricably intertwined the third time it comes before the board. They simply, we could even go so far as to argue that it's a Stigall error. They didn't enforce their own previous remands.
Let's go back to what you said earlier, that you think the court's reliance on the predication of error has been overruled by the Federal Circuit. It nevertheless still is written in all of our decisions. What panel case or en banc case do you have that has awarded each of these where there's been no concession of error? And the terms remanded, warranted to comply with the court's holding in whatever case?
There is none, but there is the Seichel case that has been discussed earlier, and more importantly, there are three Federal Circuit decisions, Rice, Motorola, and Halpern. And in each of those cases, they do not get into the mire of the remand, and in Motorola in particular, because the same panel decided Sumner-Vaughan members of the same panel at the Federal Circuit participated in both Sumner-Vaughan and in Motorola, and they clearly distinguished the holding in Sumner-Vaughan because it was based upon a change in law. The case in Akers was decided because it was remanded pursuant to Gordon, which was a change in law. As a consequence, change in law is an exception to the rule established in Motorola that when there is a remand and the agency is directed to do something, in this case to comply with Harris in relationship to deferring consideration on inextricably intertwined claims to make one final decision, that then makes Mr. Gurley prevailing party under all three of those cases. And this court need not spend the enormous amount of time looking at the content of the joint remand to look at the four corners. The only thing you have to look at is this a joint remand based upon a change in law? If yes, then Akers, Bridell, Sumner-Vaughan apply. If no, then Motorola, Rice, and Halpern apply. If that direction requires the agency to do something that they were required to do by law. And they were required to follow Harris under 7104A on the substantive holding of dealing with the inextricably intertwined claims. And that's why Mr. Gurley agreed to the remand. That's why he prevailed in this case. I don't believe I have anything else unless there's any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, the case is submitted. We will greet the bar and then court will be adjourned.